Press News Podcast, episode number 27 for the 8th of November 2009. I do apologise if your RSS has seemed to be dead for a month. That's because the show is done on spare time. And Tom Helder was not around to help with the show, and he's not here this week either. But thankfully, it's not just me talking to you. I'm joined by
Mike Ferland, technician at All Systems Repair.
You've been on the show once before, haven't you? I think it was a couple of episodes back. I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you for being able to join us again today, or me. And we've got to obviously decide a topic. It's been a month, so obviously we couldn't possibly go through all of the news on OS News. But we're going to choose a couple of, I don't know, major topics. I think the first one really to discuss is the Windows 7 launch. That Microsoft finally, after all this waiting, released Windows 7, and everybody seems to like it, but there's not much fanfare. It's not the sort of same reception that when you saw with Vista. It's been just literally ever. It's kind of been a big sort of so what sort of thing. I think it's just general people. A lot of people are relieved,
and they are relieved for the most part. We've seen a lot of people that are really happy that it gives them that extra performance versus Vista. But the application compatibility has been a little less to be desired.
Well, compared to Vista itself, I thought compatibility would be pretty much, you know, exactly the same, really. It's the same kernel and everything.
Well, it's come down to a couple issues with certain printer drivers, mostly those with HP. And HP's just been telling a lot of the customers that, hey, we're working on it, or we're working on it.
Really? I installed the... I mean, it was only a basic consumer printer, but I had to install a HP printer yesterday on Windows 7, and they had Windows 7 drivers and X64 drivers as well. So, I mean, obviously it's not the case across the board, but I'm surprised.
Yeah, these things are almost to be expected with the launch of any new operating system.
Of course, yes, we should obviously say that, it's always fallout whenever anything new comes out, and I've never known a operating system installed to be completely smooth. Snow Leopard was generally fairly smooth, it being, you know, just a minor update, as you could say, and Windows 7 is in the same vein. It is a likable update, but it keeps the same driver model as Vista, and so compatibility is generally good.
Well, for the most part. But like I said, it's just usually, you know, little things like, oh, this really expensive printer that was released like 2 years ago had a Vista driver when it first came out. You know, the printer's reaching close to end of life cycle. And, you know, people are like, hey, this is not cool, you know. But, you know, besides that, I mean, I've seen a couple issues with some of these older NT apps, and that's pretty much to be expected. But surprisingly, the XP mode on Windows 7 Professional didn't really hold up to everything it was harked out to be, especially with how it handled network shared drives and things like that. For some of these like older applications, it just couldn't do it right, no matter what we did. It's been interesting for us, because we've been on the front lines of all this.
Yeah, I've only just come across my first Windows 7 OEM computer yesterday. That was a Hewlett-Packard laptop, and it was better than Vista in a lot of ways, because Windows 7 is better anyway, but HP had done a slightly better job of the customization, but it was still riddled to the rafters with pre-installed crap. They had 7 tray icons in there, despite the fact that tray icons are hidden by default in Windows 7 anyway, so, you know, just shows they're not really just looking, you know, with their eyes. They seem to must install this stuff, shut the computer down, and never actually test it at all or something.
Yeah, well, you know, Microsoft did release some guidelines to OEMs about what stuff should be starting up with the machine. And it seems kind of funny that they're doing that to your machine that you just bought.
Oh, it's not my own machine, sorry. I should also say that I'm a computer doctor, and I go house to house fixing people's computers and things like that, so I'm in the same game as you. But I have got Windows 7. I've got it installed on my netbook. I've got an E901, and it is running really very, very, very well. That's what's so surprising, is because it's only an Atom 1.6 gigahertz single core, and it's only got 1 gigabyte of RAM. Now, that would be physically impossible to run Vista on that. You would be driving yourself mad within a few hours. But it runs Windows 7 as good as it does as it ran Windows XP. The only issue is maybe it uses a lot more RAM, about 400 meg, compared to I've got it down to about 120 on XP. And the hard drive space is a real difficulty as well. Out of a 16 gig drive, I've only got about 3 or 4 left.
Well, you know, when we tested Windows 7 ourselves, we tested on a Celeron dual core 1.6 with a gig of RAM and an 80 gig hard drive. And we were pretty pleased with the results that we had off of our beta testing and the release candidate testing on that machine. Because, like you said, you know, everything that we had in this machine was all Intel integrated, sucked, and it was crap. And it worked great, even with Aero enabled and every, you know, all the eye candy and everything. But yeah, I don't understand this launch. It's just been kind of been a little rocky.
I mean, here in the UK anyway, I haven't seen adverts yet, and it's just been so quiet. Consumers have been talking about it though, so the information must be getting through. I have had a number of consumers ask me about this Windows 7 thing, and the advice really stays the same, because most people are going to be getting Windows 7 when they come to buying a new computer. There's no real point upgrading an existing computer, even Windows XP, to Windows 7, unless you're enthusiastic enough to care about that sort of things, which consumers generally aren't. It's like, hey, you can change the engine in your car if you want to, and it will go a little bit faster. But for the majority of people, who really wants to go through that much effort?
Yeah, well, I've actually done that with one of our customers. They had to go from XP to 7, and they needed it to be as smooth as possible for all their applications.
So, tricky.
Well, actually, it wasn't too bad. You know, first you have to do the upgrade to Windows Vista Home Premium. You know, when that adds, you know, a good 2 hours onto the job. And then you go from Windows Vista Home Premium. You got to make sure you have Service Pack 1. You go from that to Windows 7. And about 45 to about an hour later with the Windows 7, it's up and running.
Why not just go straight from XP directly to Windows 7 and not have to bother with installing Vista in between that?
Well, if I remember correctly, there was some issues with doing that. You can't upgrade, do like a regular upgrade install.
Oh, no, you have to do a complete backup and reinstall. But the profiles, your user profile between XP and even Vista and 7 accordingly is just not compatible.
Well, I have no idea, man. It's just been crazy.
What's this to say, really? The thing is, I've been using Windows 7 now for more full-time as I use this netbook going house to house. I'm using it quite regularly, looking up problems on Google. It's not really that heavy usage because it's never going to be my main OS. And as I say, it's a low-power computer and it's been performing quite well on that. And it's surprising it's one of these good releases from Microsoft that doesn't happen too often. If it's like every other Windows release is either good or bad. You've had Windows 95, a decent release, and you've had 98. You can't really count, but that was awful. Windows 2000, which was very good. And XP had a lot of hassles when that was new as well. I remember when it came out, and it was quite a ridiculous operating system, really, having to require 128 meg of RAM, which is basically what a decent computer had at the time, so you didn't have much room above the minimum.
Yeah, but now it's a definite thing.
Yeah, the technology has caught up now. I think a lot of the problem with the consumers, how they saw Vista, was simply because the technology was not there at the time. Now, end of 2006, 2007, most desktop consumer machines were shipping with 1 gigabyte of RAM, maybe 2 if they were good, right? Which is just not enough for Vista at all. In fact, I've used and seen many computers that have got Vista on it with only 512 meg of RAM. The worst I've ever seen was a laptop that had 512 meg of RAM plus a 256 meg graphics card. You can imagine how bad that was.
That must have been a very slow crawl.
That was like about half an hour to start the computer up. It was basically completely unusable as sold. And so people's perceptions of Vista, I think, were a lot justified simply because of what the OEMs were selling. I mean, all of the reviewers in their ivory towers with, you know, 4 gigabyte RAM machines, etc., found Vista to be seemingly pretty good. But on the consumer front, no, it's been absolutely nothing but hell all this time. I'm constantly dealing with Vista machines that do not have enough RAM and that are just so unbelievably painfully slow.
It's we went through the same thing when we went to XP, you know.
Yes, that's true.
So,
but now with the Vista, the Windows 7 release, the your normal consumer machine will come with a minimum of 2 gig of RAM, and 3 and 4 is not uncommon.
It's very true. Very true.
So the timing has worked out well, I think, for 7. If Windows 7 was being released back then to sort of the Vista time frame, it wouldn't have been actually too bad, because it does, as I say, operate well within a gigabyte of RAM, and Microsoft could have saved themselves a lot of sort of bad press. I mean, Windows 7 ultimately is just what Windows Vista should have been in the first place.
Yes, but if we look at the development of Vista, how it had to be halted halfway through because of some of the access control problems that we had with XP. I mean, it was great of Microsoft to actually go, oh, wait a minute, this is a big problem, we're going to fix this. But it was also a bigger problem of them to not finish it right. You know? I mean, they traded security for performance, because that was the next part of the build, was to actually start, you know, fine-tweaking Vista to make it actually somewhat fast. And, you know, they had to pretty much redo the whole damn thing from scratch. But they could have waited it out. I mean, yeah, XP was at the time was out for so long, but it would have been to their favor to make a release that is refreshing not only to the eyes, but also to the eyes of the consumer, and is actually, you know, worth replacing their XP installs with.
Yeah, it's often been said that Microsoft's biggest competitor is themselves, is having to compete with Windows XP, which already does what consumers are doing already quite happily. And so I find a lot of people who outright say, I prefer Windows XP because it's been around for 8-9 years that people have managed to get used to it. And that's a odd thing for operating systems to be a single version for a good 8 or 9 year run. And that's caused some abnormality in the market, because, like for example, the reason had a lot of compatibility issues with Vista is because none of the manufacturers were geared up to developing for anything other than Windows XP. That, you know, fell on into a comfort zone. So it's going to be interesting seeing what comes after 7, really, what the time frame is going to be, because I've not really known a market that hasn't been dominated by you know, Windows XP, and that's been around for so long. So consumers have gotten used to it, businesses have gotten to it, the manufacturers have gotten used to it, and everything like games developers, etc., and things like that. So it's a real hard grind for Microsoft to get off of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they changed a lot with Vista. I mean, we had DirectX 10. I mean, pretty much the whole insides of Windows were, you know, turned and twisted inside out and changed. In lots of ways, and they actually, when they made their 64-bit version of their Windows, it was quite a bit different than how XP did 64-bit, mm-hmm. too. So, you know, in a way, that's kind of like Microsoft trying to, you know, unify the code a little bit, I guess. I'm not 100% sure on the specifics, but I understand that the 64-bit code that is in Vista is more related to Vista than it was with XP 64 being related to XP.
Yes. X64 really was a business-only thing and has only ever been sold as such and not a consumer stuff. And so pickup was extremely slow. But now Microsoft are actually pushing OEMs to ship 64-bit versions of Windows as default. In fact, this HP laptop that I was working on yesterday did come with a X64 version of Windows 7. But that brings its own interesting peculiarities of just how Windows itself is not really properly geared up for a not necessarily just geared up for 64-bit, but really just geared up for the transition, as it were, because you have, first of all, two program files directories, one for the 32-bit and one for 64-bit. You've got different binaries for 32 and 64-bit, so the user has to know what version they're on in order to download drivers and things like that. And sticking a list of stuff in front of the regular consumers that says, you know, XP64 and Vista 64, 7764, that it confuses them. They don't know which one to choose. And you even have a separate binary for Internet Explorer, which is just surreal. I have to run, like, if you want a 64-bit browser, then you have to run a separate binary, and I suspect that's just because of plug-in compatibility, like Flash and things like that.
That's very true. With
it
with
just the seems extremely flaky and hardly consumer-friendly way of doing 64-bit on Windows.
Well, you know, they're gonna learn their lessons from time with this.
Yeah, again, it's companies have been used to Windows XP and doing things in the XP-only way, which has always been 32-bit, and they never, ever had to consider 64-bit before. For now, it's going to take a lot of work before Microsoft are going to be able to iron out all of these sort of all the bumps between or the bumps of using a 64-bit system and ensuring you have the right software and everything running seamlessly.
Yeah. Now, do you believe that they did 64-bit out of necessity?
Oh, I mean, it's hard to say, because you will remember that Windows XP 64 was a business-driven thing, and that was also for, you know, the work they've done for Itanium, I can't remember the last time we were discussing 64-bit on the show, but I think that Microsoft have had 64-bit for a long, long time. It's been, you know, the NT kernel has been perfectly capable of 64-bit, probably all the way back to the 3.5 days. It might have been NT4, actually, that was 64-bit. Because they did, they run on other processes, didn't they? It ran on Alpha and run on Spark and stuff like that. So there must have been a 64-bit version of NT4. It's the user space that's the user space has always been the problem on Windows. I mean, NT is an excellent kernel, always has been. It's been years ahead of others for a while, but the user space is just awful. There's just so many problems with the actual Windows user space. So what they've done here really is 64-bit has been possible for such a long time. And they're just trying to drag the user space into 64-bit, kicking and screaming.
Yeah, and a lot of people are kicking and screaming right now about it. Especially those without 64-bit printer drivers.
Ugh.
Those are the people I feel real bad for, especially for some of these older printers, like the HP 5SI, that's been out since like the dawn of the Stone Age, but it's always just been supported. It's just finally been marked off as a mercy killing. It's terrible.
What else is there to say, really? Obviously, we didn't have the podcast running back when Vista came out. It would have been interesting how we reacted then. Me as a Mac user, this is my main operating system. The whole 64-bit thing has been pretty well handled throughout, but Apple really have had the benefit of having to shift their user space through several different transitions, where they, you know, on the previous systems, where they went from 68K to PPC and then PPC to Intel, and they've had fat binary support in NextStep right from the beginning, which they inherited. So they've been really very well prepared for this, and I don't know what to say about it, really. It's just up to all the other software manufacturers, people, third parties for Windows to get with the program, really. And that's down to the software culture. Mac, for example, the software culture is that people adopt very quickly anything new that Apple push out. As soon as a new operating system's come out, you're getting updates almost within days, that the people have recompiled their apps and they're taking advantage of new features. But it's just not really like that in the Windows world. It takes a long time for software to properly integrate with a new version of Windows.
Yeah, it's always been the case with Windows, because I believe Microsoft, because they take these very, very long development cycles on a lot of their operating systems. And when they do these development cycles, they make very drastic changes. And they do these so often that it's just like turn of the century. Either it has to work or it doesn't. With the software vendors, they have to, they have to just go with it. And with the Mac, like you said, it's always just been a smooth transition, because they've been very gradual changes and not very drastic and abrupt.
Well, I mean, it's drastic in the sense that they switched directly from PPC to Intel, but it's just been handled a lot better, because the operating system has been more akin to that kind of thing of having to have those transitions. And like, for example, when Apple announced the switch to Intel, they explained that they had been compiling Mac OS X on Intel ever since the first release. They've been secretly been doing that in order to ensure that they always had that get out clause, that choice of switching processors. So they've always kept themselves well prepared for that, whereas Microsoft, the NT kernel, of course, is fantastically portable, but the user space never has, and it's kind of, the Windows user space is dictating the hardware to a certain extent, and it's becoming, as far as I see it, it's becoming a bit of a problem, that the Windows is not adaptive anymore, or certainly as it used to be, or is no way as adaptive as other operating systems are being, like how Apple have ported Mac OS X onto iPhone, etc.
Mm-hmm. And we will only see in time if it actually will ever get any better. I mean, you know, Microsoft's been running that big campaign where it's, you know, where everybody's like, I made this, you know, Windows, and I contributed in helping, and it's basically they're trying to reign Windows 7 as being the Windows champ, like the people's champion of operating systems. That's kind of the impression I'm getting.
Oh, sorry, I have to say that again. I completely missed that.
Oh, well, I was saying that Microsoft's been running this big, vigorous ad campaign where they're advertising that the end users of Windows have really dictated what Windows evolution
has
passed.
Yes, but that seems very trite, really, considering that it's nothing of the course, and trying to submit any feedback or bugs to Microsoft is an epic journey. I think I've seen there was a blog post some time ago about how many steps it takes to submit a bug for Internet Explorer, and basically you've got to set aside a couple of hours to be able to get that done. So I found those adverts a little bit of, well, I'm technical, so I suppose I'm like that, in that mm-hmm. you know, the users came up with these ideas. No, they didn't.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, they want to... They've got a lot of bad PR to repair. Vista has been so bad. In fact, just the name Vista is universally loathed, I think, by consumers. And so Microsoft have got to distance them from that. And part of the Windows 7 name is specifically that, really, is that a consumer who's maybe not quite wised up to operating systems, because they think the operating system is the computer, then they might think that Windows 7 and Vista are two entirely different things. They're not somehow related. They wouldn't normally associate the two, and so that's why Microsoft can distance themselves. And the fact that Windows 7, by being named after a number, means you always have to say the word Windows before it.
Indeed. But, you know, even the name Vista, like you said, is almost like a common hold house name now. Like, my grandmother knows what Windows Vista is and to avoid it. And yeah. She doesn't even own a computer.
No, that's what I've been finding as well. People who don't know anything about computers, it's like defragging. For some reason, I don't know why, but it must have been Computer Mags through the 90s or something. Almost everyone I meet knows how to defrag a computer, but has no idea why. It's just that it's been hammered into them by Computer Mags over years and years and years of that you should defrag, and I've got to explain to people what a defrag is and that you don't need to do it that often.
And by Norton and by McAfee. That's what they all know.
Ugh. Horrible. Speaking of which, have you used the Microsoft Security Essentials?
I have not actually had a chance to try it. We've been busy testing ClamWin and seeing how well that works out. Because we're trying out, we're on a new kick of trying out open source and free software and anything of the ilk. But tell me about it.
Well, it's really quite good, actually. Because the thing is, ultimately, when it comes to consumer security, is that you can be perfectly secure without antivirus. It's only a tool there to help clean up and to help recognize viruses. And because it's a constant cat and mouse game, no antivirus is going to be 100%, particularly Norton McAfee, who are just as good as useless. So really, when it comes to setting up security for my consumers, my customers, I always install Firefox and advert blocking. That basically reduces the risk of viruses getting in by 90% off the bat. As long as the person is sensible about what they're doing on the internet and what they're downloading, etc., then they should be fine. And so you only really need a lightweight antivirus. what am I thinking? The Microsoft Security Essentials is extremely lightweight now, since it's obviously not as feature filled as, say, I don't know, AVG, but it's a lot less naggy. It'll only ever ask you to do anything if it actually finds a virus. So it just gets on and gets on with the job, updates automatically via Windows Update, and automatically runs a scan each week. So basically, what I said to consumers is that an antivirus that asks you questions you don't know how to answer isn't protecting you. This is the problem why I get people on Norton who block their own internet access because the firewall comes up and they don't know which option to choose.
Yeah, and that's always been the problem with those type of security suites. It's just nobody knows how to use them, and they barely work, and they costed a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So. Seen amounts of money. It's crazy, but then
With no guarantee of protection either.
No, not at all. And it just slows the computer down so chronically. I mean, gosh, anyone on iOS News will know how bad Norton has become, or its brethren McAfee. So when it comes to cleaning up a machine that's only got like 512 mega RAM, the first thing that happens is get rid of Norton or McAfee. And so this Microsoft Security Essentials is very good. It only uses about 40 meg of RAM, so it's good for computers with a very sort of limited amount of memory. Otherwise, AVG, though a bit more heavy on resources, is sort of a more powerful antivirus because it includes the email scanning components, say, if they're using Outlook Express, whereas thingy Microsoft Security Essentials doesn't. I mean, I found it to be generally very good. I've been installing all of my... Since it came out, I've been installing all of my customers' computers, and I've yet to have a problem with it. Now, obviously, it could be months and months before any problems really start to crop up, but I was using AVG before all the time, and so now I've done this change, I'm going to see what the ultimate results are. But so far, it's been pretty excellent.
Now, based off everything that I've read about the Security Essentials, it seems like Security Essentials, to me... seems like it's a really jacked up version of MRT, the Microsoft malware removal tool. So I'm gonna have to definitely check this out because I've definitely used MRT in a lot of spyware removals that I've done, and it was actually pretty successful, with CombofX and a couple other things.
I'm gonna have to
definitely check that out.
What else can we cover about Windows 7? So we are obviously just making this up as we go along. This all podcasts are not planned, and we've only two people here. This is not the easiest thing to stretch out because the Windows 7 launch has been pretty quiet. Exactly, as I was going to say, tumbleweeds. Really, it's like it's out. Great, you're running it. Yep, it's good. Thank you. There's no real massive buzz in the community about it. Everybody's enjoying it. Certainly, I think it's good, but it's just there's not the same sort of noise about it as there has been in like with Vista and previously. I suppose we only measure things by how much we hate them. And if we don't hate something, then we don't really rag on about it so much. It seems all quiet.
Well, Croc, let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Do you think with the release of Windows 7 that we may actually start to see some new OEMs appear out of the woodwork? Because some of these OEMs that have been, releasing these systems with Windows Vista previously, like Dell, HP, Compaq, you name them, you think that there might actually be a new market for some newer OEMs?
That's very hard to say. And to be honest, I mean, we're in different situations. I'm in the UK, and obviously where you are in America, it's here. There is. It's really down to the retailers, because it's the retailers, I think, that determine a lot of this, not just necessarily the manufacturers. Now, we have one of our biggest retailers here is a company called, the store is called PC World, but it's owned by a company called Dixons, who owns another of other electronic stores. Now, they're an absolutely awful company who basically sell computers to make a profit. They don't know anything about them. They're rated as probably one of the worst for consumer support. They're rated as probably one of the worst shops in Britain. And trying to buy a computer from them is a complete nightmare to a consumer who doesn't know anything about computers. And really, they dictate a lot of that, to be honest. You've got the Hewlett-Packards, and you've got Compaq and Toshiba, and Dell, who have just started to sell through PC World, simply because it's the only way they can get shop presence, by selling through PC World, whereas before Dell were very staunch that they were web-only, and that hasn't been getting them the sort of attention, really. So here in the UK, I don't really see it happening, unfortunately, unless they can get shop presence one way, and that'll be down to whether PC World accepts them or not, or they go through some other retailer, like we have a Staples, I think you have that in America, the stationary company. They sell pretty much exclusively HP computers. And with the credit crunch going on, although the recession, the brick and mortar shops are having a lot of difficulty covering their overhead. So again, without having the volume, they're finding it difficult to sell computers. So I think if anything, it's backpedaling, and we're getting a lot less choice than what we had before, and we're getting a lot less quality certainly than we had before.
That's very true.
I can't see it really changing until we get a new class of devices. And with, as I mentioned before, really with Windows user space, is that we're not going to get a new class of devices when Microsoft are the dominating factor and Windows is not adept to new devices. I mean, it's like the whole netbook thing. Netbooks have been very popular, but Windows Vista has not appeared on basically any netbooks, bar maybe the Sony VAIO-P that I can think of, and even then, you know, that was a bad decision. But Windows 7 is much more netbook friendly, and they've created a Windows 7 Starter Edition to a sort of even more crippled version than the Windows Home Basic, Home Premium, to go on to networks. But that's how hardware limitations, like you can't have more than a gigabyte of RAM, and it's got to be a certain processor and a certain speed and so forth. And that's what worries me the most, is that Microsoft still dictate the market so much, and it's just crippling the innovation to insert new devices into the market. I'm very interested in the ARM nettops and netbooks and things like that, but I haven't seen them yet, and they should have been here in July.
Well, we'll only see in time what's going to happen with the market anyways.
But. Yeah.
Anyways, so the perfect OS.
Yeah, let's move on. You're quite right.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, because Windows 7 clearly isn't our perfect OS. It's nice. I wouldn't call it a perfect operating system.
It's good change.
Yes. Smooth. This is a news article. It's not a news article. I just dumped a load of ideas on my blog about what sort of things I would tackle if I was trying I said perfect operating system, but I kind of said that only for the purpose of OS news, and I should have worded it a little bit better, because it was really just if I could sort out a lot of the really annoying bad historical tag-alongs that we've got with operating systems, and design something that was very nice to use but was still essentially common present day, then this is how I would do it. I would remove brands from operating systems, because we get too much bloated monolithic applications like iTunes and things like that, and stuff like that, stuff that I would redress in operating systems. And so I've asked OS News, what would make your perfect operating system if you could just clobber bits from here and there, and you could replace this bit with some better idea, and basically make something that you would be happy using each day.
If I could wish for anything in a perfect operating system, I'd say it would be that every time it's updated, there are little to no regressions in performance or features. That's a given.
Yes. For example, the WebKit project, you're not allowed to regress speed at all. Any check-in must not regress speed. And so if you've got to put in a new feature, you've got to then go find somewhere you can gain some extra speed elsewhere if you want to get that checked in. So they are relentlessly working towards speed. With operating systems as a whole, unfortunately, because of the third-party issue of what you're plugging into an operating system, the stability is always going to be tricky about doing an update and always being successful. With Google's Chrome OS, it obviously doesn't exist just yet, but I suspect, given what Chrome is, that Google will probably do security updates on Chrome OS completely silently and transparently, just like they do with Google Chrome browser. That will be very interesting, because obviously it's going to set off a lot of privacy alerts, but honestly I think it's a very good thing if the operating system, when you power it on, is just always up to date, and you don't have to manage that.
So what you're really wishing for is transparent upgrades.
Well,
and updates.
Updates too, but what's interesting about Google Chrome is that the version number is not important. That's only really a developer thing, is that the end user doesn't see what the version number of Google Chrome is. They just use it. It's always up to date. It's always the latest version. They don't get adverts for now version 4, download and install this. And I think that's an interesting way of doing software. I think that's how things will go in the long run, maybe the 5 to 10 year span, is that we'll do away with version numbers and you'll just always have the most recent version. We won't have so much of a focus on version numbers. And that will be, a good way of shipping software, is that it will always be up to date, and we won't make such a big fuss about new features. We'll just focus on making them easy to use and better, and really polishing the experience for the end user, rather than just ringing geek bells.
Yeah, and that's what it should be about. Maybe an operating system shouldn't be so geeky.
That's a lot of sort of what I was addressing. I mean, it was my idea of what I'd like to sit down to, but there is, as I was alluding to, is that with operating systems at the moment, there seems to be a lot of pipework on show. It's completely unnecessary why some folders are even visible because of their technical nature, and why this feature is here because it's so technical, and why do we show them hard drives when they don't even know what a hard drive looks like, and just oddities like that that have just come along with us for the ride with legacy. And I think that operating system should be focused on the end user.
So they should be very task-focused and streamlined.
Well, by task-focus, I mean the primary part of my ideas were that there were no applications to speak of. It was entirely based around your files that you would focus on, rather than being application-based, where you'd open a monolithic application and then choose which file you want. You would open your file and you would get whatever editing interface was relevant to that file or that you had selected. Instead of this, because this is how it was. This is what's so funny, is that way back in the beginning, when the UI was invented, we had the right idea, just didn't necessarily have the technology to do it in the most elegant way. Things like the Lisa OS, where it was where everything was solid state. You could pull the plug out of it whilst you're in the middle of a document, plug it back in, and then bingo, you'd be back typing your document. Why don't any operating systems do that anymore? Where did we lose that? Why do we shut down and start up operating systems? Where did that useless feature get introduced? I mean, the Amiga, you just flip the power switch. You don't do this shut down and wait for 4 minutes.
Well, software has become complicated over time.
Yeah. We haven't fought the right battles at the right time. We've just copped out, I think, and a lot of this has been dragged along in history. Rather than saying, no, this isn't good enough and doing it properly, we've said, things like shutdown and startup have creeped in, and they've got longer and longer and longer, and they've only just started being properly addressed now. And what else was I talking about just moments before? Good, my mind is a mess. And just this whole, ideas that they had better in the 1980s with operating system, when you had the diversity and when the operating system GUI was a new thing. They had good ideas, just not the best implementation. So if only we had iterated those ideas, we would have gotten somewhere, instead of this application-centric process that rewards the geek but just makes things, punishes anyone who's trying to just get some work done.
Yeah, maybe what we should see in the future of operating systems is dropping of legacy. I think that's what's really hurting OSs today, is that there's just so much legacy code, and there's so much legacy this and legacy that, Windows in a lot of ways has retained a lot of its legacy look. The Windows still have those, those buttons on them just like that. The scroll bars still work just about the same. And a lot of the interface kits have stayed the same and still get implemented like they did from Windows 3.1, like, you can still pull up those old file open dialog boxes and see them in all their glory, and their 8.3 file extensions,
which is still under the hood. Yeah, so that's, and the Windows is, if I say, it's a great big lumbering user space that is completely not adept to getting with the times, and because of this Microsoft Windows being the monopoly, it's holding everybody else back. We can't break this compatibility. We can't rethink things because we can't launch a new product that will have any hope of a chance because of the OEMs and so on and so forth. It just aggravates the whole issue. This is why it's interesting with new technology coming out that Windows can't run on, that we have a possibility of seeing something entirely new, and why Google Chrome OS is very interesting, why Moblin is very interesting on the Linux side of things. Because it's really an attempt to redress some 25-year-old designs.
But even if they're trying to redress these 25-year-old designs, it always comes back to the issue of, will the end user actually implement and use? I mean, as soon as you start breaking some of that compatibility with those older applications that everybody's still hot and wet about, they just can't move forward.
That's the geek crowd, though. I mean, if you can make an operating system at the end of the day that allows, most regular users to do what they need to do, which is computers are generally a glorified internet box these days anyway, then you'll still have been successful even if you can't run Photoshop on it. I mean, this is the idea of Chrome OS, really. You can be successful by making something that is really good at browsing the internet. The fact that it can't play DVDs is basically irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when we have things like YouTube now and Hulu. Yeah. Who needs a DVD player? No. No, nobody. They got YouTube now and Hulu. Who needs that?
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, because we're so caught up on this idea that everything must implement Photoshop, otherwise it's worthless. Why would you use that? Then we're missing the opportunity that something can be really good at some other task.
You know, in a way, it's almost like it's holding back humanity. You know?
I mean, that's what I think, really, when it comes to this. Whole Microsoft monopoly and Windows is that, sure, Windows is nice, but it is not the example of what the best that mankind can possibly produce.
Not at all. I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to install Service Pack 3 on Windows XP and just had it blow up in your face before, but I mean, that's divine testament to that, you know, to all of that. No, Windows, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised obviously I don't understand fully as not being a full-time Linux user, but I was surprised in the article the number of people who said that Linux basically was already their perfect operating system. I cannot wrap my head around that.
Me either, man. Like,
it seems to be completely lacking imagination. Linux, again, is not the pinnacle of what we can do with computers. It just seems like a horribly eclectic, bloated, and punishing system that once you've learned it, you come to love it like some sort of Stockholm syndrome. But again, it's not really making the computer a tool for us in the best possible way.
Well, Linux has its own merits. I mean, yeah, if you Absolutely. Know what you're doing, you can make it your
All perfect
system.
All operating systems have something that they do which they are very good at. Even when we're talking about Haiku or BIOS or these very minor operating systems that the first thing people say is, well, what's the point? It doesn't have X and X feature. Is that all of these operating systems exist because there is something they can do that no other one can.
You know, I'm really hoping Haiku does, you know, start to mature and develop, you know, very soon. I'm really, really excited about it. Because I almost see that as almost where the future was supposed to be, like when we saw BOS and how elegant that actually was and how well it, performed and how well it could have taken over the market, but how well Microsoft stomped all over them. But, you know, that's what I really saw as a future years and years and years ago.
Yeah, so obviously BIOS now is only a Haiku is now is only a re-implementation of a 2001 OS. It's not an implementation of a 2009 OS. That's the thing. They've only now gotten back to where they started from, essentially, in being able to re-implement R5. So now is the part where they take it somewhere else. But BIOS, if it had been the dominating operating system at the time and we had 9 years of development of BIOS, it would now have solved all of those problems that it's got about hardware acceleration of graphics and all the software and things like that. If BIOS was in place of Windows, I truly think that we would be significantly better off.
You're damn right. I mean, when us geeks looked at BOS and we're actually really playing with it, you know, everybody that loved it, man, they saw, like, the future of computing, you know, multiple processes, multiple threads, you know, like, you know, just the ability to actually harness the power of their computer and not watch it like suck down and die and run at a slow crawl. Hmm. You know, and we were doing these with pretty insignificantly powered machines at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine what that could do with, like, on today's hardware.
Exactly. If you've got a very fast operating system and software that is written to work on, you know, multiple cores and processors and things like that, then we wouldn't have such a problem that we're having now of trying to get over this hurdle of software just not being ready for parallelism. We'd have solved that years ago. We had 8 or 9 years to polish, you know, developers had that long to polish their capabilities of understanding parallel design, etc. But now we're only just starting to get to grips with it. The whole market is 10 years behind.
Indeed. But, you know, it's just imagine what the future could have been. You know,
that's the thing, and it's whether or not we're going to really get there in the long run, or we're going to be able to sidetrack off to somewhere where we should have been. And again, it's whether down to Microsoft Windows. Microsoft themselves need to obsolesce Windows and move on to something else themselves. They've been doing a number of some solid research with what they've done with Barrowfish and Singularity. And those projects to try and rethink a lot of the under the hood stuff, and they need to be able to implement a new user space. But compatibility is going to be that millstone around their neck that they're not going to be able to get rid of it, even if they massively rethink Windows or come up with an entirely new product that isn't Windows. How they're going to bring that to market dominance, I do not know.
Well, that's the hurdle that Microsoft's eventually going to have to hit.
I think it's probably going to be their downfall. I mean, I'm not such a zealot as to think that Microsoft are going to completely die and disappear, and Linux will be ruled the desktop or whatever. I just think that, as I alluded to in previous articles I'd written, that Microsoft basically aren't leading the way anymore. They're not the market leaders. They're having to catch up all the time. All they are doing is catching up, and it's going to come to a pass at them at some point. Where they just the market, the technology, the computing world is going to go some other direction, and Microsoft can't move because their technology is not positioned in the right place, and they're going to be completely cut off.
You know, and that's kind of the thing where it's like, do you think that would be any different if Bill Gates was still in charge?
It's hard to say, because obviously, you know, the whole Vista debacle did happen whilst Bill Gates was still in charge of the company, and Steve Ballmer, Monkey Boys, is doing an absolutely atrociously bad job, but he's only really a good figurehead for doing a bad job. He's an easy person to point to. I think it's deeper than that, and I don't think it would necessarily be any worse or better with with Bill Gates at the head. Really, I think it's the middle managers that need to be taken out and shot. and as I think someone else... my memory does not help me out, but there's a number of people in Microsoft who are getting it, who get it, but they are basically hindered by a culture in Microsoft that has always been very negative and so brutally competitive. That these people with ideas about, you know, openness and a new Microsoft, etc., are having to fight against people like Steve Ballmer, the sales guy, to bring Microsoft into something new. And really, it's down to whether or not they are going to actually do that. If we're going to see something truly open and new, and see Microsoft cooperating and see Microsoft contributing to standards rather than trying to fight against them all the time, particularly with this whole HTML5 thing.
Yeah, well, the other thing I was thinking about is, imagine if years ago, if BOS could have shipped with something like Wine, where it could have maintained that Windows binary compatibility so you could run some of those old apps. Do you think maybe there would have been a hope for it?
an operating system doesn't have to have compatibility to be popular, to gain a following, everything. Like, it just has to do what it does well.
Yeah.
I mean, we can buy netbooks that don't come with Windows, but we don't complain about that because they can still browse the web perfectly fine. And I don't complain that my television doesn't run Windows or that my car or this and that. So the concept that everything must be compatible with Windows is just inherently wrong, because that's a geek view of things that we grasp onto particular brands and particular applications and not particular tasks. We should all know better that you are supposed to learn the way of doing something, you know, the actual understanding behind it, rather than the particular specific way of doing it with a specific piece of software. We learn word processing and spreadsheets rather than specifically Word and Excel, so that you have a portable set of skills to go around. And that's the same should be with operating systems. You should be able to sit down at any computer, and it doesn't matter what operating system it is, you should be able to figure it out in 5 minutes and get some work done. And we're so adverse now. We've been used to this idea of Windows being all-encompassing, dominating, and just using that operating system and everything being about Windows, that we are now adverse to the idea, frightened by the idea of sitting down to a different operating system. And that shouldn't be the case. We should be changing operating systems every day, you know, using from one device to another and not caring about that.
And exactly, that's the way it should be. And I think, you know, maybe down the road we're gonna start using a lot of different devices that, you know, are gonna run Linux, are gonna run, you know, whatever Apple puts out there for the next mobile device, or whatnot. You know, there's always going to be these new devices that are going
to
come out.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's what's going to, the future is going to be, is that we're going to get some more diversity back into the market by new hardware, which is going to be able to sidestep Windows completely because Microsoft can't support it. For example, you know, the ARM netbooks, but I mean, even that, Microsoft are so desperate that they've there was that ARM netbook, what was it called? That they run Windows CE on it instead of using like a perfectly good Ubuntu ARM. I mean, why would you want Windows CE on a netbook? Good grief.
Yeah, Windows CE is horrendous.
Yeah, that's how desperate Microsoft are, and also just a sign of just how bad the Windows user space is, and how you just can't move it around like that. Whereas Apple are not going to have these problems. The tablet, if ever such a device occurs, or whatever they do next, the iPhone OS is going to be a very good base for them for new devices, and if it's mouse based, then it will be Mac OS X. And again, and even then, they could adapt it to something new yet once more, because they've got that. They've got it all. They've got a portable system there.
Well, you know, Apple did acquire PA Semiconductor not too long ago, so I think they're going to probably start utilizing some of that and start coming out with some devices based on, you know, their buyout of PA Semi. If I understand correctly, PA Semi was working on PowerPC, power-efficient processors?
Yes, I believe so. Tom had mentioned that the last time we brought up PA Semi, I think it was the Apple show, that yes, they were PPC-based, which would be very interesting for PPC stuff to come back into existence. But if they were to do another PPC-based device, then it would probably be on something like iPhone OS rather than going back to the desktop OS, because the march to Intel has been so one-sided.
Yeah, and I think they've had a pretty successful march with the Intel transition. I mean, yeah, there's Hackintoshing now, and you know, people left in the dust if they still have, you know, a PowerPC Mac and they want to run Snow Leopard. But besides those kind of things, I think they've had a pretty successful transition to Intel, and it's worked out for the better for them. Especially everything else that's come out at the time, you know, like LED backlit displays. And other such, you know, breakthrough technologies that
raises something interesting, is that Microsoft really need to get themselves back into the hardware game here. We should say, obviously, that Microsoft have released their own store, and they basically cloned the Apple store and just branded it Microsoft. But they're selling what are called Microsoft Signature PCs in their stores, where these are PCs that have been pre-configured by themselves so that they are literally crap-free and don't all have this preloaded OEM rubbish.
Well, that's certainly a step in the right direction for them. I mean, what would be holding Microsoft back from building their own PC?
Yeah, I think that's something they need to do, is they need to have some hardware vision here. Apple are you know, abreast of the technology that's coming out and rolling this into their designs that are getting ever better. And Microsoft don't have anything yet. They don't have a Microsoft PC that says this is the way we think should things should be done, and the OEMs can fall into line behind and have some vision here.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of scary, because I know that the DOJ here would probably freak out. If Microsoft, you know, if Microsoft started building their own PCs. But on the flip side, Microsoft's always made some pretty good peripherals, and their hardware that they've
even
made in the
Mac
past
user,
has been pretty good.
Even as a Mac user, I think a lot of Apple users themselves would also say, would not disagree that Microsoft make very good hardware. I mean, when it comes to mice, I only buy Microsoft mice. I won't buy anything else.
Exactly. I mean, you get the Microsoft Natural Keyboard, Microsoft Mouse. I mean, you get the whole deal, and it's just perfect.
I've got an IntelliMouse Silver 3 here, and that's, I don't even know how old that is. 5-6 years old? Probably more. And it's still doing me very well. In fact, it annoys me that a lot of the new Microsoft mice just are not as good as their old ones, like the IntelliMouse 3.
Well, I've tried out a couple of the new ones. Like, there was like a $89 keyboard mouse wireless combo we got at the shop just to try out. And it was actually pretty good. I have to say that actually the mouse, like, the only thing that felt kind of funny was how the scroll wheel worked.
Yeah.
It was a different type of scroll wheel, not like a clickety clickety.
No, that's
of
what
thing.
I don't like. Is the older mice before 2007, 2008 is they have the wheel is just so much more better. It just falls into place when you roll it. Rather than being so gummy. That's what I don't like. And the horizontal scrolling mouse as well, rubbish. They're awful.
Yeah, well, the peripherals, you know, those are another thing that hopefully will get better with time. But, you know, Microsoft could probably pull off a good PC. I mean, they already have the hardware vendors in their pockets, because they cater to their hardware so that they can buy their soft. You know, it's already a good relationship that they have. But what's to hold them back from actually doing their own?
Well, Dell have kind of pulled themselves out of a rut, really, because about 4 or 5 years ago, they were kind of, you know, in a lot of trouble, and they have managed to pull themselves back out of that, and I can recommend Dell again now as a decent brand, because they've been doing more of their own hardware design. You've got the Studio Hybrids and Studio range of laptops. You've also got this new Dell One, which is a sort of, you know, their own idea on the iMac. So Dell obviously are beginning to show a lot of vision now.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I have to say actually really starts to set Dell apart from the rest of the crowd now is a lot of their desktops are actually really quiet. And, you know, for me to build an equivalent quiet PC, you know, I'd easily be going over what the Dell build would be. But it's just amazingly quiet, and actually some of it is really intelligently designed to be serviceable, which is a really big plus for, you know, guys like you and me that, you know, do these kind of things. And that's what I really appreciate about what Dell's doing now. I haven't heard much from their customer support front, but I remember that was always a really big, big problem with Dell, is they had horrendous customer support.
I don't think it's any better particularly, in fact, because it's just like internet service providers, but they're just crap across the board. That's just the way it goes, and you can only just hope that you don't have to deal with any support with these sorts of things. There's not much I can say about that, to be honest. Getting back on topic, though, if we are obviously discussing what's the best OS in the world, we don't want to be necessarily hanging around Windows all the time, or Mac OS X, or Linux for that reason. We need to have, you know, a lot more vision beyond that, because it's very hard to say what I'm even going to be doing in 5 years' time, as software-wise and things like that. Is everything going to be entirely web-based? Are we going to all move to web apps or things like that? Who knows?
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, in the future, there's going to be all these new devices. I mean, there's been a lot. I've done a little bit of research here and there about you know, AR, you know, augmented reality.
Yes, that's true.
And I'm curious to see how that might actually change up the game a little bit. And making the rest of these devices, you know, interoperable is going to really change the game.
Yeah,
especially with things like Bluetooth, Wi-Fi. You know, our devices can talk to each other in many different ways now, and what would happen if we could actually string them together?
a lot of a continual trend that's been happening is this cascading of our daily needs, our daily computer needs down from the traditional full-on desktop computer down to the laptop, down to the mobile phone, the pocket computer, a smartphone. So where before you had your desktop computer, you did everything on your desktop computer. Then you bought a laptop, and then we've changed over to having laptops as our main computers. And now there are people who are using the laptop less and less, and doing a lot of their daily on-the-go computing using their smartphone and everything. And so, if we can get the balance right, this shift is going to continue until we rely a lot less on full, large, traditional operating systems other than for serious work where you need to sit down for a large amount of to do word processing, spreadsheets, and artistry stuff like 3D rendering and so forth, where you need the power. But for all our web browsing, I think that's going to almost completely move to these mobile devices.
It's true. There's just no way around it. I mean, like me with my smartphone, I'm doing a lot of my email, you know, things that I'd normally use a computer for, like email, chat, you know, just even looking at the weather and stuff, just for those, you know, web-based services. I'm using my smartphone a lot more for those than I would a regular computer. I've actually, over the last 3 months that I've had my smartphone, I've probably used my computer you know, an hour to 2 hours less every day than I would have on any given day without the smartphone.
That's true. Yeah, now I've moved to a netbook, which obviously still being traditional operating system, I've began to find this same shifting as well. Now I've got at home, my main computer is a MacBook Pro, and it just has the power and the hard disk space and everything to do everything. But now that I'm on the move all the time, I'm trying to use that as a sort of the netbook as a web browsing device and as a as for like mobile blogging and everything like that. So this balance is things are starting to shift, and web apps, etc., are beginning to become more useful and practical because I'm not sat in front of the same thing all the time. For example, I just recently installed Fever Feeder, a RSS app on my domain, and I'm trying that out as far as an RSS reader so that I can use the same RSS management, etc., on my desktop computer as well as my netbook computer. So having apps that are transient, that work across devices and things like that, I think that's going to be another important issue, is that it actually, if anything, while we're talking about perfect operating systems, in fact, if anything, operating systems themselves are going to be greatly diminished come the future.
Well, I believe that we're going to probably see a lot more operating systems over time. I mean, people's needs have changed in computing by far. And, you know, with all this new hardware that's coming out, there's definitely going to be a lot of new system software that's going to be running on these devices that no one's ever seen or heard of before. And it's going to be geared towards a specific purpose. So,
okay. I think we should probably just about wrap this up. But yeah. I was wondering if there's anything other that you would add to as far as to what features or design issues that you would put into your own perfect operating system.
You know, in design, I'd say that the operating system should be very maintainable and very easy to maintain because, you know, updates, you know, doing hard disk checks and stuff like that should be really easy and forward to the end user to be able to do those and be able to perform their own maintenance hassle-free. Because like you said before, you know, people don't know how to use their antivirus software. They don't know how to, you know, do their updates. They don't know how to, you know, do anything really other than their one application for the word processor and a web browser. So If those features could be made a lot easier, and more accessible, that would definitely be part of what I want out of the perfect operating system.
I think one of the core principles of what needs to happen is a refocus on the end user and not just geeks.
Yeah.
because not enough operating systems are caring or becoming less and less caring about the individual end user and their needs and doing so. Even Mac OS X, I'm finding, is becoming less and less individually tailored. And we need to return to a focus on that like we had in the 80s and sort of the early 90s, that the customer is king, that the computer user is the most important person here, rather than the brand, you know, as trying to keep furthering the company brand rather than really helping the customer at the end of it. Because all I'm doing, my job is just basically fighting against companies doing stupid things. I'm always uninstalling crapware. I'm fixing problems from manufacturers that are doing things wrong. I'm dealing with rubbishy software and stuff like this. And if these companies could just get their act together and the focus was on the end user's experience, then a lot of these problems would just simply go away.
That's a definite. It's, you know, the refocus of the end user would be amazing. I mean, yeah, you know, you log onto a computer, it says it, you know, hey, welcome, you know, whatever the user's name is, and it tries to be all friendly and cute and cuddly. But when they actually try to get any work done, it's a pain in the ass.
Mm.
So.
Okay. Let's finalize this. I think we've got probably about an hour show out of that. Thank you very much, obviously, Mike, for joining me today. Because it's been a month since the show's been out, so I think people will be very happy to finally receive something at least. And okay, what's left to say is emails. If you'd like to email me anything about the show, I'll forward you anything we get, Mike, as well, if it mentions you. You can email us at crew@osnews.com. And I was going to say Twitter, I suppose. Do you have a Twitter at all, Mike? Or where can users follow you or find out more?
Go to allsyst.com, and I have my contact information there. You can just email me through the shop.
Okay, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm twitter.com/croc, but I've recently stopped using or downplayed, reduced my Twitter usage a lot. So if you want to talk to me, you'll have to app. Reply me anything, but really it would be best to email, which is available freely on my website. That's all left to say, really. Thank you very much for listening, and hopefully, who knows, we might have a show next week.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye.